Hey, good afternoon, Juno. It's just seconds before 3 o'clock, and you're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. Pat Moore, back from Europe, where I've been for the last 3 weeks, and glad to be the host again on Friday afternoons for a Juneau afternoon. Today, I have a wonderful lineup of guests. In just a few minutes, I'll be introducing the financial aid director from UAS, Corrine Soltis. We've been sitting here in the studio talking while you were listening to the end of the last program, and we're all ready to tell you about a new program at UAS. The Tara Lee Ellis will be here to tell us about the Girl Scout Recruitment Drive. There's a movie showing this week at Goldtown Nickelodeon. It's called Blackfish, and Samantha Berg, one of the people in the film, will be talking to us from Palmer. And, of course, it's Food Truck Friday, so we'll hear the details on that. Stay tuned for Juno Afternoon.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The South Dakota Highway Patrol and the Crow Creek Sioux Tribe are combining law enforcement efforts this weekend. South Dakota Public Broadcasting's Gary Ellenbolt reports.
The Crow Creek Tribe and South Dakota's Department of Public Safety signed a Memorandum of Understanding Thursday. The agreement covers jurisdiction and legal issues the Highway Patrol will handle on reservation land during the weekend powwow. Highway Patrol Major Dana Svensson says both sides have worked a long time to put the MOU together.
Crow Creek Tribal Chairman and Police Chief Scott Shields had reached out to us a while back and asked if there was some way that we could come together and possibly assist them with some of the enforcement issues that they have in the area and that they're anticipating.
Svensson says 7 troopers will assist the tribe in law enforcement at the powwow. A large crowd is expected at the event, in part to celebrate the 150th anniversary of the founding of Fort Thompson. For National Native News, I'm Gary Ellenbolt.
A federal official discussed the importance of nutrition programs with Native people this week in Oklahoma. KCMP's Brian Brazier has more.
At this week's National Native Women's, Infants, and Children's, or WIC, conference in Tulsa, participants heard remarks from Audrey Rowe, administrator for the USDA Office of Food and Nutrition Services, who said the tribes are doing wonderful work to help find ways to make families healthier.
The WIC program, where it is having an impact on the reduction of diabetes in very early children. And so how do we continue that progress? How do we build on that progress?
Ms. Rowe also toured a nutrition services site in the Chickasaw Nation and saw the benefits of a food distribution store. Ms. Rowe said after visiting the folks in Indian Country, she will take a clear message back to Washington, D.C.
One of the things that you find in Washington is we talk numbers, but you need to put a face on these. People need to understand the people who are benefiting from this program and why they're in these programs.
For National Native News, I'm Brian Brazier.
Claremore Indian Hospital recently became the first in Oklahoma to be designated as a baby-friendly hospital. As Susan Shannon reports, health professionals say things like breastfeeding may help people avoid future diseases like diabetes.
Georgiana Sweetwater, who goes by Gibby, is the nurse manager for OB Inpatient Services and the women's clinic at Claremore Indian Hospital.
One of the things that was brought out of the last 20 years is an increase in the rate of diabetes, obesity amongst our young people. And there's a direct correlation and tie to formula feeding.
Jenna Meyer is the lactation consultant at Claremore Indian Hospital. After policy updates and rewrites, she said it was crucial that staff and the new moms be educated on successful breastfeeding.
When they're informed about the steps and what will be going on, they're more successful.
Claremore Indian Hospital serves all Native Nation members in Oklahoma, Texas, Missouri, and Kansas. I'm Susan Shannon in Norman, Oklahoma.
The Southwestern Association for Indian Arts kicked off events this week in New Mexico for its 92nd Santa Fe Indian Market. People from around the world travel to Santa Fe for art, cultural performances, and other events like a film festival. Recently, the association signed a Memorandum of Understanding with the Institute of American Indian Arts. The MOU is aimed toward providing a stronger partnership between the organization and the tribal college, says SWIA board chair Stockton Colt.
Provide a means so that we, IAIA and SWIA, can work more closely together to develop over the long term programs which will be beneficial to their students and to Indian Market.
Dr. Robert Martin is president of IAIA.
increase educational opportunities for our students and alums, and also giving them the opportunity to sell their art.
IAIA focuses on contemporary art and media, while SWIA promotes both traditional and novel art forms. The partnership provides a formal framework for program collaboration and mutual services. During this month in 1986, an act of Congress restored federal recognition to the Klamath tribes in Oregon. Government termination policy decades earlier heavily impacted the tribes. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
You're in tune with KTOO News. It's 5 minutes and 53 seconds after 3 o'clock, and we're in the middle of Juneau afternoon. Pat Moore, your host today. My first guest is here from UAS, and Corrine Soltis is the financial aid director, has been, I guess, for the last couple of years out there. Hi, Corrine. Hey, welcome aboard. Let me turn the correct mic on so we can hear you talk. I am out of practice, a little bit shaky here. No, I got it. Anyway, I think the main thing we need to talk about is this new program that has started, I think, this year. Is that correct?
Stay on Track started last year.
Last year, okay. Mm-hmm. But this is called Stay on Track. What's it about?
The program is based on trying to get students to do the math so that they can see that it really takes 30 credits to graduate within 4 years instead of the average that students take, which is 24 credits. So we're trying to show them that to graduate in 4 years with a bachelor's degree, they really need to take a total of 30 credits. At UAS, we're encouraging them to take 15 credits per semester.
Okay. So with a 15-credit load per semester, that means you're taking, what, 5 courses or?
Between
4 and 5. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So if there's a math course in there, those are usually larger credit count.
Correct.
Yeah. And PE classes are, like, smaller credit count.
That's so, right.
Yeah, okay,
mm-hmm.
Okay.
A lot of PE credits.
Uh-huh. But you do the arithmetic, and the idea here is that you line up the things that you have to take, and then you nick them off 15 credits at a time each semester and stay on it.
Yes.
And you get a reward for doing that, right?
Yes. At UAS, we want to encourage students to participate in the program to really see that 15 credits per semester is the best way to finish school faster. And so to do that, we offer a $500 tuition waiver to help students cover the cost between the traditional 12 credits to get them up to the 15.
So the $500 off the tuition, and the tuition at UAS is not exactly astronomical to begin with.
Nope, it's a very good value for a bachelor's degree.
Now, does this preclude you getting scholarship assistance or any other assistance?
Nope. It all comes together for one good financial aid package from UAS.
Okay. So, in other words, you could apply for scholarships. You could use government availability loans and some of the grants and that sort of thing.
Yes. This is something we're offering on top of a student's traditional financial aid package.
Okay. So, I guess I have to ask, can you get into a point where you owe the student money for taking...
Well, that's a good question. The totality of their aid could produce a refund. That's true. But this particular tuition waiver just waives the tuition, so it doesn't have a cash value associated with it.
Is this available to all students who are pursuing a degree?
It's available to undergraduate students. There are some qualifications. This is a continuing student opportunity, so students have to be sophomore, junior, or senior status.
Okay.
Which means they have to have at least 30 completed credits. It is focused on undergraduate students, be that bachelor, undergraduate, AA, certificate, undergraduate.
So AAs are eligible for the program.
Absolutely.
As well. Okay.
Yep.
All right.
And
uh-huh.
The student also has to have completed a FAFSA and be eligible to receive financial aid.
Okay. So those sound like reasonable requirements.
Mm-hmm.
Assuming that a student is currently enrolled at UAS and is listening to us right now, what would they have to do in order to make themselves eligible for this $500 rebate?
They need to make sure that they are in a degree-seeking program, at UAS. They need to complete their FAFSA and turn in. The FAFSA is the free application for federal student aid. They have to complete any documentation that we need to be able to offer them a financial aid package, which the financial aid office is more than happy to help them figure out. And then they need to sign up for 15 credits.
Okay. The financial aid office is located where?
We're on the main campus at Auk Lake, and we are in the Novotny building upstairs.
Okay. And if a student, some of your courses, some of your students wind up taking classes at the other two campuses of the Southeast system because they're offered at a time that works in their schedules and like that, would that do anything to their eligibility?
It still qualifies them. They need to take 15 credits between all of the UAS campuses and also any of the UA campuses.
Ah, so they can take a distance course from UAF even.
That's correct.
If it were necessary.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
We're trying to make it as easy as possible. The goal really is to get students to graduate in 4 years, and we want to make that as easy for them as we can.
So I'm trying to do the math in my head, and unfortunately, I'm not being successful here. Assuming that I were a student and I enrolled in this program and I managed to qualify with all of those qualifications, how much money would I save over and above what I have to pay?
That's a really good question. We actually have done the math for you. Just in tuition fees, books, and supplies, by not having to go for a fifth year worth of school, that'll save a student about $10,000.
Huh.
Once you factor in the cost of living expenses, room and board, and the lost opportunity cost of getting a job a year earlier, it can push way beyond $20,000 a year for taking that extra fifth year. And it's really easy to avoid that just by taking one extra class per semester.
Yeah, yeah. So there's a real strong incentive here for people to do this. How many students, you started the program last year.
That's right.
What percentage of students are taking advantage of it?
I can't tell you percentages, but I can tell you that we had about 130 students take advantage of it in the spring with amazing success rates. We had 84% of our students that participated in this program in the spring completed 15 or more credits. 92% completed 12 or more credits, which is amazing success rates. We're very pleased.
I asked you this question beforehand. If a student were enrolled in this program and for some reason had to drop a class, what does that do to the tuition offset? Does it affect
We you? Don't pull the tuition waiver after we've given it to the student. So, but we do have rules about dropping credits and not passing your classes. So those would still apply like they would to any student at UAS.
Right. Okay, so essentially all that really is necessary here is to do the stuff that you'd normally have to do in order to get any financial aid at all, and then sign up for 15 credits.
That's right.
Yeah.
The value is really amazing in terms of how much a family can save by participating with this. Our scholarship for a sophomore, junior, senior student for those 3 years is $3,000. A student that's already in, for example, getting the APS scholarship.
APS.
The Alaska Performance Scholarship.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm.
So a student already getting that, combining it with this scholarship, it makes it worth almost $5,000, or in some cases over $5,000 per academic year. So it's a great value at UAS.
So you could come out without a debt load. A student could.
Yeah, it's possible.
Could engineer this
once,
to come out, yeah.
Once you add this to the other types of financial aid that we can offer, absolutely.
Yeah, and that's becoming a major issue nationally about people who are having horrible life experiences trying to figure out how to pay back big student loan balances and like that.
It's true.
That's not here so much because the university system in Alaska has always been fairly reasonable as far as particularly for in-state tuition.
Mm-hmm. And we strive at UAS's financial aid office to help any student that might be struggling with their payments. So if there is a listener out there that needs help with student loan debt that they already have, needs some advice, or thinking about taking on some additional student loan debt, they should definitely come by and see us. We'd be more than happy to talk to them about it.
Corrine, this is not the only program you have available. I mean, there's still a bunch of scholarship money that people can apply for.
Absolutely.
What's the process for doing that?
To apply for financial aid, the student needs to complete the FAFSA, the free application for federal student aid. They need to be admitted to UAS. We combine those two things together and then let the student know if we're missing, say, some documentation or need to clarify some information. Once we have the file completed, then we offer the student a financial aid package. They accept it within 30 days, and then we start the ball rolling for them.
Okay. Do they have to write essays for some of the scholarships or that sort of thing?
We do have a scholarship application through our UA Foundation. The deadline for that is April 15th of next year for next year's
closed for this year?
They have, but students can fill out the application now for next year. They do need to write an essay, but it's not an intimidating essay. It's very easy and it's very organic for most students to write it.
Yeah, it's basically just a little kind of story of yourself.
That's right. Sort of thing.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. And not very long either.
No.
I seem to remember it's about, 250 words or something like that?
We accept pretty much any length. If the student wants to share their information with us, you know, it's always good to learn a little bit more about our students, and our donors certainly appreciate knowing about the students that we have.
Yeah. There is an amazing opportunity here, and I'm really glad that you brought it to our attention. So just to basically review the bidding here, students who are currently enrolled at UAS as a sophomore, junior, or senior, if they have 30 credits, which makes them, they have sophomore standing, then they can apply for this program, and all they really have to do is just fill out a FAFSA. And come by the financial aid office and get everything on file.
Yep, we will help them the rest of the way if they take that first step of completing the FAFSA and signing up for 15 credits.
This is excellent. Thank you so much for telling us about this.
Thank you.
Welcome. Come down again and tell us about other programs like this.
Thank you.
A little appropriate music here.
Your money doesn't care about you. Just look at what it puts you through. You spend all that time chasing nickels and dimes. Then one fine day you're surprised to find you're dressed up in your Sunday best, laid out for your eternal rest. And all the money over which you have sweated and bled doesn't even know you're dead. Money makes you big and money makes you small. Money gets you high, money breaks the fall. Money blows your horn and money makes you crawl. Your money's got you right where it wants you. Money tells you what you want to hear. It whispers funny ideas in your ear, like how much better you are than the other guy. So you deserve a bigger piece of the pie. It says that you're a king among pawns. It tells you you can do no wrong. It says there was never anybody half as clever as you, and you're just dumb enough to think it's true. Money makes you big and money makes you small. Money gets you high, money breaks the fall. Money blows your horn and money makes you crawl. Your money's got you right where it wants you. Money, what we would not do to sweeten up the pot. Money, who we would not screw to get more than we've got. Money, it's the stuff of dreams, the tail that wags the dog, a perfect substitute for brains or taste or God. Money makes you big and money makes you small. Money gets you high, money breaks the fall. Money blows your horn and money makes you crawl. Your money's got you right where it wants you. You can say it ain't so, but you know that it's true. Your money doesn't care about you.
I love KTOO. All these wonderfully entertaining things that I listen to while I paint.
That's Juno artist Constance Baltuck, who has generously donated her painting, Waterfall Salmon Creek, as a 40th anniversary fundraising gift for KTOO.
we're offering a limited edition of 200 prints signed and numbered by the artist. All proceeds benefit KTOO. To learn more, visit kto.org/anniversary.
It's just 20 minutes after 3 o'clock. You're in tune with KTOO News. Pat Moore, your host today for Juno Afternoon. And it is time now to learn how it is possible to become a Girl Scout in Juneau, Alaska. Tara Lee Ellis is here, and she tells me that she is a lifetime Girl Scout.
Correct. I started Girl Scouts when I was in Brownies, so second and third grade.
There you go.
And kind of continued up through. And the great thing is that Girl Scouts is still going strong, over 100 years of scouting.
So how many, what do we call them, troops? How many groups are there of Girl Scouts in Juneau?
Sure. In Juneau, we have over 30 troops, and hopefully we'll be starting new troops once school begins next week. Girls run from kindergarten age all the way up to 12th grade. So kindergarten, first grade, you get to become a Girl Scout by being a Daisy. Then second and third grade to the Brownies, and fourth and fifth to juniors, and sixth cadets and higher, all the way up to 12th grade.
Okay, and then you have seniors.
Seniors, yes.
And that's how old are seniors?
So seniors are usually the 11th and 12th graders.
Ah, okay.
And then you can always become a lifelong member. Once a Girl Scout, always a Girl Scout.
Ah, okay. Now, nationally, I seem to remember an article fairly recently that I was reading that said something about the fact that the Girl Scouts activities had changed over time. And as would be expected. But I'm wondering how that reflects in your experience.
Right. In my experience, you're kind of right, as you mentioned, that, you know, we're not your mother's Girl Scouts. We're not just about crafts, cookies, and songs. The women are, the girls becoming women are into science, technology, engineering, and math. I had a group who went up to Anchorage and worked on underwater robotics with the different groups up there, or they're working on dissecting fish and really getting their hands dirty, as well as the crafts and cooking, learning how to camp, outdoor survival, how to dress a deer, just like the women's group that they have here in Juneau. There's a girls group similar to that.
For kids of various ages, you mentioned Daisies and Brownies. So what kinds of activities do the very young girls get to engage in?
Right. So it kind of depends on what your troop would like to do. For Daisies, of course, they're starting school and learning new stuff. So they do the crafts and cooking. But they've also learned to do Women of Science and explore different technologies. They get to go to the different museums and whatever that troop leader kind of guides the troop of having it be a girl-led experience. They kind of decide as a troop what they might be interested in this year. So maybe some are interested in marine life, and so they'll go spend some time at NOAA. Or we have a group who really wants to sew, and so they're learning about different ways of how to sew or different things.
You've mentioned troop leaders about three times now, and I'm wondering, what are the qualifications to be a Girl Scout troop leader?
So to be a qualified leader, you have to have enthusiasm, want to do it. A lot of times their parents are JVs. They clear background check, and just be ready to have fun and be flexible with our girls.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. They don't have to be Girl Scouts themselves?
They don't have to be Girl Scouts. You don't have to have any experience in scouting. Just be willing to lead a troop of 5 to 10 girls.
And then once you've volunteered to do this, how does the national or the local Girl Scout, how do they support the group?
Right. So here in Juneau, we're blessed. We have an active Girl Scouting community. And so Girl Scouts, we have different meetings. There's trainings to go to, networking with other leaders to meet to kind of support your troops. You get tagged with the sister troops, so you're not in scouting by yourself. They're great friends, which is the other purpose of Girl Scouting, is that it's a whole connection and network of building girls with confidence, courage, and character. And we're also building leaders of courage and confidence and character as well.
The courage, confidence, and character. You say that like it's like a motto or something like that.
It is one of our mission statements of what Girl Scouting is about, and it is. You know, three of the seven keys to building resiliency in children, and, you know, having girls with great courage and self-esteem and the confidence that if you look at our NASA astronauts, and I think it's 6 out of 7 of them were Girl Scouts before, look at our current Troop 49 with Kathy Munoz and the legislation and women in power, they're Girl Scouts, and they're still Girl Scouts today. So it really instills something.
When a girl decides that she, or when a family helps their daughter join the Girl Scouts, is there a great deal of expense involved in proceeding?
So the annual cost for the year to become a Girl Scout is $20. We have financial aid available, and then there's different avenues of which they might get the uniform or earn their patches. Depending if the troop has fundraising or if they attend an event, they'll learn it and they'll get it by participating in the event. So there is some cost involved, but we try to make it affordable for all families.
Okay. Now, we've talked about a lot of changes in Girl Scouts, and I'm becoming seriously concerned about my cookies. Don't tell me that they're going to abandon the cookies.
They are not going to abandon the cookies.
I'm relieved.
I gave some to Jeff already.
I'm greatly relieved. So.
Yes, and that's just a part of so many skills they learn from selling cookies. People love to eat them, but the girls are learning so much more than just handing over a box of cookies. So, like financial literacy skills, public speaking, it's a great program.
Outstanding. Well, I'm relieved.
Good.
I was thinking my mint patties were going away for a moment or two.
No, those thin mints are here to stay.
Okay, good. All right. Well, I'm greatly relieved. But it sounds like a really exciting series of activities for young girls and older girls of all ages. What's the next step that's going to happen? You were mentioning a sort of an open house recruitment thing.
Correct. So I'll be at the back-to-school fair tomorrow. If you want more information, you can stop by my booth. But a back-to-school registration family event is going to be held at the Mount Roberts Tram on September 2nd at 11 a.m. So families can come and register their girls to become a Girl Scout. We'll work on getting them into a troop or the different pathway they choose to participate in. And then families can ride the tram with us at a reduced rate, little fun celebration.
So the gathering is down on the...
Down at the lower...
Yeah, okay.
Just the entryway.
So you don't
have
to ride up.
You don't even have to ride up. You can come kind of meet the Girl Scouts, sign up, kind of learn
but
more information.
But you got some cut-rate tickets that'll get everybody up to the top.
Kind of thing.
And maybe go for a hike or something.
And they can go for a hike. Last year we did it. It was pouring down rain. So I'm hoping this year the weather will be better.
If you let the rain stop you, you do not live in Juneau, Alaska.
We would not do anything, yes. They were troopers. They were amazing hiking through the fog.
Tara Lee, this is a great program. Thank you so much for bringing us up to speed on what the Scouts are doing.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
I appreciate you coming in and telling us this. One more time, the time and day for that deal at the tram is?
Sure. September 2nd at 11 a.m.
September 2nd, 11 a.m. If you're interested in enrolling your child in the Scouts, it's Labor Day Monday, and it's coming up pretty quick.
Exactly. Thank you, Pat.
You bet. My pleasure.
Tonight on 360 North at 8, Prospects for the Resolution of U.S.-Iran Conflict is this week's Juneau World Affairs Council presentation. At 9, Europe's Debt, America's Crisis highlights the interdependence of world economies. Great Decisions in Foreign Policy is at 10, followed by Platts Energy Week, This Week in Defense News, and BioCentury This Week. It's a great way to look at public affairs tonight on 360 North and 360north.org.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Friday, August 16, 2013. It's the birthday of William Maxwell, born in Lincoln, Illinois in 1908, novelist, short story writer, and an editor at the New Yorker magazine for 40 years, from the 1930s through the 70s, during which time he published Frank O'Connor, Eudora Welty, Vladimir Nabokov, Alice Munro, John Cheever, John Updike, and hundreds of others. Maxwell lived in Lincoln for only 14 years, but later said that the town provided three-quarters of the material I would need for the rest of my writing life. But his childhood was far from idyllic. When he was 10, his mother died from influenza, which he'd contracted while 9 months pregnant. It was an event that he would return to again and again in his writing, and it formed the basis for his second novel, They Came Like Swallows. He once wrote, "I couldn't understand how it had happened to us. It seemed like a mistake, and mistakes ought to be rectified, only this one couldn't be." At the New Yorker, Bill Maxwell, as he was known there, had a reputation for being a meticulous editor, strict, kind, helpful, and trustworthy. He was also very tactful. He once took a train an hour and a half north of the city so he could tell John Updike in person, with regrets, that the magazine was rejecting one of his stories. And it's the birthday of Charles Bukowski, born in Andernach, Germany in 1920. He has published numerous wildly popular books of poetry and fiction, including Run with the Hunted, The Days Run Away Like Wild Horses Over the Hills. Late in his life, Bukowski said, "Every day I wake up around noon. Then I'll go to the track and I'll play the horses. Then I'll come back and I'll swim, have dinner, and I'll go upstairs and I'll sit at the computer and I'll crack me a bottle of wine and I'll listen to some Mahler or Sibelius and I'll write with this rhythm, like always." And here's a poem by Paul Muldoon entitled This Last Great Country Song. I took the interstate in a 53 V8. I followed her from the Haight Ashbury to Ashbury Park, and my spirit soared with that coast-to-coast billboard. Now I get my kicks when mail-order mavericks fill the billboard charts. But my heart still aches when I think of the kiss into which we rushed headlong. I don't know if I can take much more of this last great country song. I danced a jig at the Blind Pig. I took another swig from a fifth of Maker's Mark. I walked the buzzard buzzy sky where the deer were getting high. Now I'm on the floor at the convenience store loading soda into a cart. But my heart still quakes when I reminisce on drinking all night long. I don't know if I can take much more of this last great country song. With its failed crops and its foreclosed loans, its store-bought whiskey, its wit homegrown, its waitresses who's left no traces of their panty line, their X-tans, their monster-trucking X's, their dash-mounted fans, their fanned-out cartridge cases, through which I ran for my life from a guy with a knife. I'd been led by his wife to their trailer park, where the strung-out utility poles still found no use for our lost souls. Now I'll be running for mayor. I'll be leading a prayer, breakfast, next to Walmart. But my heart still breaks to think I'll no longer be remiss, to think I'll no longer do wrong. I don't know if I can take much more of this last great country song. This Last Great Country Song, a poem by Paul Muldoon from his collection Songs and Sonnets, published by Annatharman Press and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation, offering poetry podcasts to listen to and thousands of poems to read at poetryfoundation.org. This is Billy Collins for the Writer's Almanac, hoping you will join us next time.
It's 27 minutes before 4 o'clock. You're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. My next guest on Juneau Afternoon is coming to us by telephone from Palmer. And it's Samantha Berg. She is a former trainer who worked with killer whales. And there is a film that's going to be aired here in Juneau for the next several days. It's already been at the Goldtown Nickelodeon, a couple of showings, but it's tonight at 7:15 and 9, and then Saturday, Sunday there's 2 shows, and Monday there are 3 shows, and at 7 o'clock after, or between the 7 and the 9 showing on Monday, Samantha is going to come in by Skype and talk to the audience at will. Samantha, welcome to the program.
Hi, great to be here.
Yeah. So, Samantha, can you tell us a little bit about Blackfish, the film?
Sure. Blackfish is about, it's really the story of Tillicum, the whale that killed Don Branto, the trainer, on February 24th, 2010 at SeaWorld of Orlando. And it looks at his history, how he got to SeaWorld, how he was taken away from his mom when he was a little bit over 2 years old, and how he was at SeaLand of the Pacific, and he killed a trainer there back in 1991. And then SeaWorld brought him to Orlando, and he ended up being one of their main breeding whales. And then eventually he killed a park guest that ended up in the water with him, and then he killed this trainer really 20 years after he killed the first trainer. So it chronicles his life, and you kind of get to see what killer whales' lives are like in captivity. And you also get to see some behind the scenes at SeaWorld, looking through the trainers' eyes, people who work there. Me and several other former SeaWorld trainers talk about our stories, how we wanted to be trainers and what we thought the job was going to be like, and then what we saw while we were there, and then how we eventually had a change of heart about how SeaWorld was treating the animals.
There was an article in this in today's paper, yesterday's paper here in Juneau, that talked about the fact that in the 1980s, there was a program to try to capture 100 orcas in Alaskan waters. I don't know if you're familiar with that or not.
I just heard about that. Yeah, I was surprised. I'd heard a little bit of a rumor about that, but yeah, it's apparently true. And apparently, SeaWorld was they didn't allow it to happen, but they were planning on capturing 100 orcas, and then they were going to keep 10 for their collection, but it never ended up happening.
Yeah.
But they did have several scientists looking at doing a feasibility study for that.
Yes. So the film's goal, it's a documentary film, and the biggest goal behind the film is to try to push toward not using orcas in a circus-like environment in places like SeaWorld.
Exactly. Well said. And I wouldn't say it's a push, because it's not really an activist movie. It really gives people the chance to make the decision on their own. Because you get to see this whole movie unfold through the eyes of the trainers and through the eyes of the people who actually captured the animals and who worked with the animals. You see that what we've learned after having these animals in captivity for 40 years is they're just not suitable for captivity. We already know that these animals are so intelligent. They have very complicated social structures. They swim 80 to 100 miles a day. They just don't thrive in captivity. The mortality in captivity is like 2.5 times higher than it is in the wild, and they die pretty horrific deaths in captivity as well.
Samantha, you were a trainer yourself for quite some time.
I was. I worked at SeaWorld of Orlando for 3.5 years.
And you must have trained before that in order to be able to take that position.
Well, I was an animal science major undergrad, so I was planning on becoming a veterinarian. And that's in what you just said, actually. Most people assume that you need to have some specialized knowledge become a SeaWorld animal trainer, but you really don't. The qualifications that they were looking for at the time was that you were a strong swimmer, you had CPR certification, that you sounded good on a microphone, and honestly that you were physically fit, that you looked good in a wetsuit. And beyond that, it was all on-the-job training. There aren't many places that you can go, college programs where you can learn to be a killer whale trainer, so you really, or any other trainer for that matter, and there's a couple of programs now in the country, but mostly it's on-the-job training. So I happened to have all the qualifications when I applied and I got hired. But interestingly enough, not a lot of people there, even when I was there, had even undergrad degrees. I just assumed I was going to be working at a place where actual science was being done and there were people, you know, PhDs doing research. But the only research that I saw when I was there, other than just trying to figure out how to keep the animals from dying, you know, keeping them alive, I saw one guy come in. His name was Frank Fish, and he was doing a study on hydrodynamics, looking at water moving over the surface of the whales when they swam in the front pool and by the front glass. So that was the only science I saw the whole time I was there. I was pretty shocked.
Was this like a dream of yours?
It was, you know, like a lot of people, I think I grew up as a little kid. I was watching Jacques Cousteau's Under SeaWorld and Mutual of Omaha's Wild Kingdom, and I always remember thinking, wow, you know, I'd love to work with big cats, or I'd love to swim with dolphins. And then I ended up getting a little bit more practical as I grew up, and I thought, well, you know, it makes more sense to be a veterinarian, and I went to Cornell University, got my degree in animal science, and then I was kind of disillusioned about being a veterinarian because I worked at the vet school for 3.5 years, and I saw that the veterinarians were, you know, they had it pretty rough and they weren't particularly happy people. So I thought, well, you know, what if I went back to my original dream, which was, you know, getting a chance to swim with dolphins and killer whales? And so literally at that point, I sent resumes all over the country and I got an interview at SeaWorld and I thought, okay, well, this is my job. But that's how, you know, it was a dream that I had as a little kid, but I let go of it and then I came back to it after I realized that I wasn't ready to go to vet school.
Can you talk a little bit about, obviously you've had a change of attitude here. And maybe a change of belief structure, I'm not sure. But
yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So sure. Can you talk about how that came about?
Yeah, it's a little bit complicated because for me, you know, as an animal science major, you know, you're learning about working with animal husbandry and how to take care of animals like cows and horses. So I had a little bit more of a utilitarian approach to working with animals to start out with. So I kind of fit in perfectly at SeaWorld in some ways because I thought I was there to do a job and the animals were there to do a job. It wasn't quite as romantic, although I did have, you know, all sorts of dreams about wanting to swim with killer whales and dolphins. I didn't see some of the stuff that was going on behind the scenes, like really what was going on, because I just thought that's just the way it is. It's just part of animals being in captivity.
You mean you didn't take notice of it?
I didn't, you know, I think it's a cognitive dissonance that happens.
Yeah, okay.
It's like, you know, stuff goes on and then I want to believe that what SeaWorld is telling everybody, which is, you know, this is the world's foremost facility for killer whale research, study, and display, and animals in SeaWorld have it better than they have it in the wild, and that's what I was telling people, and part of me wanted to believe it, you know, and in order to continue to do the job and to get to swim with the animals, I had to, in some ways, it was like a compartmentalization that had to happen so that I didn't actually think about some of the stuff that I saw. There were two things in particular that really blew me away and that, you know, in retrospect should have sort of woken me up a little bit. One was the death of a dolphin. She was a captive-born dolphin whose mom died from complications of a fungal antifungal medicine she'd been given, and so she was very subdominant, and the female dolphins would basically attack her and push her around so she would throw up her food, and eventually she starved to death because it became more reinforcing for her to throw up her food and play with it than it was to eat it. But the thing is, this was a behavioral problem, and here I was as an animal trainer, and we couldn't even solve this problem. You know, I watched this animal that I loved, who I could jump in the water with and just coddle like a teddy bear, just starved to death. And then there was another time where there were four false killer whales at the Whale and Dolphin Stadium while I was there. And at the time, I didn't know anything about the dolphin drives in Taiji, which are documented in the movie The Cove, which won the 2009 Academy Awards. I had no idea what it meant that these animals were from Japan. But in fact, they were from the dolphin drives. And so they'd been driven into coves and their families had been slaughtered. And then they'd taken only the best-looking animals into Japan, and eventually they got over to SeaWorld, and I worked with some of these animals, and I saw one animal die horribly. She just beat herself to death against the side of the pool, swimming in these tight circles, and eventually just threw up this incredible amount of blood and sink to the bottom of the pool. And then one of the veterinarians who was watching this whole thing just turned to the other one and said, "Oh, I thought we were out of the woods with that animal." And at the time, you know, I thought, wow, you know, we're just doing frontier medicine. We don't know anywhere near as much as we should about how to take care of these animals. So those two things stand out for me as like something was not quite right there in terms of the kind of care that we could offer the animals and even about how the animals got there in the first place. But it really took me seeing the photos of Don Branto lying in the slide out next to Tillicum, the killer whale, and hearing SeaWorld saying that it was her fault, that mm-hmm. she was in fact responsible for her own death, and that she let her ponytail dangle in front of his mouth and that he pulled her in, which turned out, of course, not to be true. So that was what woke me up, and I kind of started rethinking all of my experience at SeaWorld, and that was when I started, about 6 months after that is really when I started speaking out.
And you appear in the film as one of the people who are interviewed about the situation.
Yes, I do.
Okay. When they approached you, did you approach them or did they approach you?
No, they actually approached me. What happened was Tim Zimmerman, who's a writer for Outside Magazine, he wrote a story called Killer in the Pool about Don's death and about Tillicum's history. And he interviewed two former SeaWorld trainers who I worked with in the 90s, Dr. Jeffrey Ventry and Dr. John Jett. Jeffrey Ventry he's a physiatrist now in Washington, and John Jett's a professor for Stetson University. And he interviewed those two people, and Gabriella Cowperthwaite, who ended up directing the film, yeah. read Tim Zimmerman's article. And then that's how I got connected with Gabriella, and then I was asked to be in the film.
Yeah, she actually began this film attempting to determine why the killer whale had killed Dawn.
Exactly. Her question really was, why would, you know, a killer whale kill its trainer, you know, especially somebody with 16 years of experience? And I think part of that is because of the way SeaWorld presents these animals, like they're cuddly sea pandas. know, they really present this attitude that the trainers have this special relationship with the animals, and they make everyone in the audience want to have that special relationship with the animals. But on, you know, the truth is you're dealing with a top predator, in some cases animals that, you know, brutally kill sea lions or other whales, you know. So you're not just dealing with a trained dog, you're dealing with a wild animal, and there are consequences to putting yourself in a, you know, close proximity with those animals.
Did you feel you were in danger when you were training?
And I never did while I was there. And that, I find that really funny. That's another piece of cognitive dissonance for me, is that I even read some stuff about what had happened in the other parks. But I didn't know all of the details on a lot of the accidents that had happened. I mostly have found out a lot of stuff only in the past 3 years after Dawn died. But the truth is that while I was there, it never occurred to me to be afraid to go in the water with the killer whales. I was nothing but excited. I couldn't wait to jump in the water with them.
I think the only reaction that I know about from SeaWorld in response to the film is basically to say that they had no responsibility for this and that it was Dawn's ponytail that caused her to get killed. And so far they've been dead silent on the park guest who was found dead of hypothermia draped across Tillicum's back and the first trainer who was killed.
Well, there's a couple of things there. Actually, they were silent initially. All they did was just put out a standard statement of like of the movie that basically was saying that the movie forgot to mention that they take really good care of their animals and their trainers. But about a month and a half ago, they put out an 8-point statement that refuted some of the things they said that the movie said about the park. But it's really funny when you read their 8-point statement. You can go to IndieWire.com and just Google Blackfish responds to SeaWorld or SeaWorld responds to Blackfish, and you can see it almost looks like they didn't watch the movie, because they accused the movie, for instance, of saying that that the movie was still saying that SeaWorld was taking animals from the wild, when in fact what the movie did accuse SeaWorld of was breeding an animal who's been responsible for the deaths of three people over the past 20 years, and he's responsible for 54% of the animals in SeaWorld's collection now have Tillicum's genes. Another thing that they contested was the lifespans of killer whales in captivity. They said that the data is not isn't solid, and of course, I mean, this is scientific data that's been around for 40 years. So, and then another thing I think they said was that the movie accused SeaWorld of separating moms and calves when the calves were too young, and SeaWorld said, "Oh no, we don't actually move the calves until they've been weaned." But when you're saying that, you're saying basically, we don't take the babies away from the moms until they're at least 2 years old. So it's still like taking a 2-year-old away from its mom. You know, it's, mm-hmm. it's not any better. So there's a few things like that have come out. But otherwise, that's been their statement so far.
Samantha, we'll have a chance to talk with you again when you appear on Skype between the 7 o'clock and 9 o'clock shows. So that should probably be about, I think this movie is about an hour and 15 minutes long, an hour 20,
yeah,
something like that.
83 minutes, yeah.
Yeah, so you'll be appearing on Skype to the audience at the Goldtown Nickelodeon Theater on Monday night between after the 7 o'clock showing. If you want to catch the movie tonight, it's at 7:15 and 9. Saturday and Sunday, there are two showings at 4 and 7:15. There's three shows on Monday, 4 o'clock, 7 o'clock, with Samantha at the end of the show, and 9, and then Tuesday, 8 and 9:30, and Wednesday is the last day you can see it, 7:15 at 9. All of those showings are at the Goldtown Nickelodeon. Samantha, looking forward to hearing from you on Monday night.
Thanks a lot. Thanks for having me on the show.
Yeah, thank you so much for giving us all of this detail on Blackfish, the film that is at the Goldtown Nickelodeon and raises some really controversial points about this sort of use of killer whales. Thank you.
Thank you.
This is Bird Note. Uncle Remus told us how Br'er Rabbit fooled Br'er Fox by pleading, "Please don't throw me in that briar patch." Many birds, like this song sparrow, also thrive in dense, thorny blackberry thickets. For small birds, blackberry thickets provide shelter from larger predators, unable to penetrate the thorns. In addition, birds living in briar patches enjoy the tasty fruits when late summer rolls around. Lucky birds, they'll have no competition from leaf-eating Br'er Rabbit. Although chipmunks also love a good briar patch and a good blackberry. Other birds that make these thorny thickets home include California quails and wrens, as well as many kinds of wintering sparrows. Himalayan blackberry was introduced into North America. Some consider it one of our most noxious invasive species, but birds and beekeepers love it. And in some urban settings where little natural habitat remains, it provides such good bird habitat that there is justification in letting it persist. Today's show brought to you by the Bobolink Foundation. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein. Can't always hear Bird Note, but don't want to miss it? Sign up to have the show sent to you every week. That's birdnote.org.
support for this program comes from Balloons by Night Moods, offering new and used Halloween costumes from infant to adult sizes. Balloons by Night Moods, located at 9342 Glacier Highway in the Valley. More info at 523-1099.
There's this great program that's been going on all summer long, and I've had the joy of being the guy on Fridays who gets to interview the folks who are doing this thing. And I've got them right here in the studio for today. This is Food Truck Friday. It's what the Jack did instead of a farmer's market this year, and I think it's been a wild success. The concept is that you surround the Jack with food trucks. And other portable food producers or purveyors, I guess would be the right term. And then you throw some tremendous entertainment on from inside, and everybody goes out and gets a plate from the food vendors and brings it in, and the round tables are set up, and you get to sit there and be entertained. And so with me are Amy Houck and Rhonda Gardiner. They're part of the Juno Jam Busters, a ukulele orchestra, I guess, if you have four adults and two kids.
I wouldn't go that far.
We're getting really close to an orchestra. Violins on the right.
Ensemble.
Okay.
And, a motley crew.
Yeah, and then Michael Christensen is here, and he's actually channeling Eric Caldwell, who was...
Hello.
Anyway, he's with Morally Impoverished, and they'll be playing over there. I guess minus Eric. You said he was
Eric here? Is... has the flu, and he's hallucinating, and he really wants to see how he improv.
So he's going for it.
He's hitting the NyQuil, and he's going to be there, and he's going to make less sense than me.
So we're
looking forward to that.
This is in the true spirit of improvisation.
The show must go on.
Yeah. And Lisa Miles of Heartstrings was not able to make it, but she also will be performing over there. Mm-hmm. And everybody needs to know, I guess, that if you miss this when you've missed it. This is the last Food Truck Friday of the season,
mm-hmm.
but boy, what a run it has been. I don't know who the food providers are today, but what I have to say is that I've eaten a couple of times at this little venue, and it's a chance to sample some really nice stuff. There's good food over there.
I'm hoping for fry bread and rhubarb sorbet.
I saw the fry bread guy setting up. He's like a hot dog or a burger guy. I can't remember. He was setting up. And Mark Wheeler has been running in and out of preschool, which is what I really do. Well, the other thing I really do. And having us try his different ice creams. So I had a something stout, like a chocolate cake stout or something like that. Sort of like beer and ice cream all wrapped into one.
I was going to pimp the potato salad, but I'm not going to cut it at this point.
You can do both. Yeah.
There's a Steinbeck novel with a beer milkshake right in the middle of it that I'm remembering now.
The reaction
was not good. Not good. Doc was the central character. I think that's Cannery Row, if I remember it.
Not pretty.
Anyway, no. He said it was... tasted flat. Yeah. So, what is the ukulele ensemble going to play today?
Oh yeah, we'll have a couple Hawaiian tunes.
I'm surprised.
Yeah.
I have to say I'm shocked.
Right.
Okay.
We don't actually. That's not all we do. No. We do it. We love them, and we do a few of them. But we have a couple of original tunes. Reed Tippett's is one of our members, and he writes some fun songs, and he's going to play a couple of those. And we have John Lager. He's going to be on what I'm affectionately calling a baritone ukulele, which is actually a tenor guitar.
The four string. Guitar.
And they're the same tuning, this is a slightly larger body than a very ukulele, but just four strings, so we're letting him play with us.
We're calling him one of the ukulele.
So a wide range of old stuff from the 20s and 30s, a couple of new pop songs, and then we have a couple of Rhonda's son Reed and my daughter Selma will be playing a couple tunes on guitar. They've been busking down at the tram all summer and being very successful. So.
Yeah. Okay. So that's going to be, what order are you in the shows?
We're second.
You're second. So who starts it off?
Lisa Miles.
Lisa Miles. Right. Okay, good. And these are like 30-minute sets?
Yes.
Yeah, rough numbers? Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay. Mm-hmm. Okay, and then after that is the improv?
Yes.
I want to ask you what you're going to do because you have no idea, right?
Right. Well, we have more idea than last week.
Oh, okay.
last week we did Rorschach Pattern 9, which we never know what that's going to be.
Uh-huh.
And this week we have Kate Laster joining us, and we're going to do Poetic License, which is our own twist on the Herald, which involves a freestyle poem and then a story and then a sketch based on audience suggestions.
Okay. Can you expand this a little bit? I'm
sure.
I'm trying to figure this out. So,
well, the audience...
So tell me about a freestyle poem.
A freestyle poem, we talk to the audience and get their input, and that's up to each performer about what questions they're going to ask the audience for.
Okay.
And, you know, it could be something like, what is your favorite album?
Okay, and then you turn this into a poem?
Yep.
Okay.
And
okay.
Then from that, there's a, someone will tell a story from their life. One of the performers will tell a story, and then we'll do a sketch, an improv sketch that's based on what went before. It can sometimes be very tangential, based on one word that we liked or an emotion that was in the poem. It can vary completely, and that's why it's improv.
Uh-huh.
So it's like a scavenger hunt, except you don't know what you're looking for, and you don't know you're on a scavenger hunt. So it's exactly like that.
I've always been
sensitive.
Kind of
sounds like playing the ukulele.
Well, we're going to improv playing the ukulele, so it's all going to tie together. It's very thematic.
Jazz musicians.
Yeah.
If you have a jazz quartet or something like that, and there's a thing in improv called the offer. And part that's how most sketches start is I make you an offer, and then you have to respond to my offer, and then that's where we take off from. And the very same thing happens when improvisational musicians are working with each other. And one of them basically, you have a melody of some kind, and that starts the thing, and everybody kind of has some ground rules that they're going to play with. But then someone in the band will make an offer. And the response to that is very, very similar to what you're describing here, because as you watch the development of the music, and this is probably the most common in bebop, which was a jazz form that was real popular in the 70s and 80s, was somebody would make a completely non-related melodic offering to the piece, and then everybody would have to pick up on that, and the fun was coming back around to where you could get back to the melody, you know, and how you were going to get there was usually the big adventure of the game. And I would imagine that's...
It's exactly what we do. I mean, sometimes we do it bebop. Sometimes we do it free jazz. Sometimes we do it standard. So it's I think the music metaphor is very apt. And some of our... free jazz is a little less intelligible, which is always the problem with free jazz. And it's like, what are they doing there? But fortunately, nobody gets hurt usually.
I remember a great sketch from years ago on television where someone was introducing the members of the band. And he introduced the sax player and the other members and the other instrumentalists. And then they had a guy on radar. And the host said, what's the guy on radar do? And he says, he warns us if we approach a melody. So.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I don't know. Does that happen with the
not on purpose.
Well, you've got to work it in.
Well, you know, that's the thing. I think our anything that comes across as improv is more of a rescue.
Yeah.
At this point, Amy actually has been a musician for a long time, and she plays the fiddle, and she grew up playing piano and all kinds of other things, and has a lovely singing voice, and when she goes for a note, usually actually hits it. I learned ukulele when I was in elementary school growing up in Hawaii and hadn't really played until I was a grown-up, and then when my husband bought me one, the only time I played it was in the dark, putting my son to sleep.
Oh, mm-hmm.
Very good audience. Very receptive,
yeah, yeah.
You know. And then I saw Amy performing. We met each other at the Barney McClure. What's that called? You know, that the cabaret workshop.
Cabaret. Hey.
And Amy was actually playing it. So.
Okay, I got to dive out of here.
Let's go.
We got about 40 seconds to close things up. You folks are all part of tonight's Food Truck Friday over at the Jack. It starts at, I think, 5:30, right?
Yep.
Yeah, first act is up on stage probably about 6 or something like
no,
that.
No, 5:30 okay. Is the Lisa Miles.
Lisa Miles, mm-hmm. And then 6, and then like that. Okay,
mm-hmm.
Folks, thank you so much for coming in and posting us on what's going on.
Thank
here.
You.
Let's close this thing out by saying that this is KTOO Juneau. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juneau and Douglas. We're also on a set of translators throughout the area in the Valley and Auk Bay. We're on K... 276 AF at 103.1 in Lemon and Schweitzer Creek. We're on K269 AO at 101.7. Gustavus hears us on K201 AM at 88.1. K220 BT serves Hoonah at 91.9. In Excursion Inlet and Icy Strait, you can hear KTOO on K210 AS. That's at 89.9. And in Juneau, you can also receive KTOO on GCI Cable Juneau, digital channel 871. Our sister station KRNN is on 872, and KXLL is on 873. And we're also online continuously streaming at www.ktoo.org.
It's been called one of the best folk shows on public radio. A mix of bluegrass, old-timey, singer-songwriter, roots, music, and more. A Mudlark Sampler has been bringing quality folk music to Juneau listeners for over 30 years. Hosted by a selection of local volunteers, the Mudlark Sampler has just the right mix of music for a Saturday afternoon. A Mudlark Sampler, Saturdays from noon to 2 on KRNN, Juneau, 102.7 FM.